Romans and countrymen. Kidding. Friends, welcome to Daily Power Parsha, where the Torah is always the same because the Torah is eternal, but the jokes, that's also the same. But the intro is always a little bit different, perhaps. Welcome back. This is our daily excursion into the Torah reading. Today is Tuesday, March 23rd, 2021. And as such, we will be looking at the third reading of our Torah portion, which is Tzav. And I need to begin by telling you something that I did not tell you yesterday. And that is that the word Tzav means command. Tzav means like mitzvah. It's like the middle of the word mitzvah. So Tzav means command. And the Torah portion opens up with God telling Moses that this is what you should command your brother and his kids, the priests. This is what you should tell them. This is what you should command. But Rashi says something so beautiful. Tzav doesn't just mean command. Tzav means to encourage. But more than encourage, it means amen. Tzav means more than just encourage. It means to be mezarez, which means, what's a good English word for that? Zerizut. It means to encourage to the extent of alacrity. Does that make sense what I'm saying? Alacrity? The idea of doing it quick, of being on top of it, and not letting it kind of, you know, letting it just be on a back burner and something I'll get to, but something that is top priority. I want to share this with you on my screen. Let's see if I can find it. Tzav Torah reading. Boom shakalaka. 1 second. Here we go. Here we go. I'm going to go back to the first reading because this is the Rashi that I want to share with you on the opening. On this, well, the second verse. Tzav. Hebrew Tzav says here command, but as we'll see soon, Rashi throws us a wonderful insight. Rashi says, Tzav, the expression Tzav always denotes urging to promptly and meticulously fulfill a particular commandment for the present and also for future generations. That's a lot. It's a big mouthful of words. I was this close to not getting through it. I'm just saying, from the clutches of certain doom of vocab, this is what's going on. So it's urging to promptly and meticulously fulfill a particular commandment. So the idea of Tzav is not just this is what you should do, but it's about encouraging, urging, do it promptly, do it soon, with alacrity, with energy, do it carefully. It's really hard to, it's one Hebrew word, lezarez or zeruz or zrizut. It's one Hebrew word that has a lot of English words to explain it. It means to be on top of it, to get it done right, and to do it with an energy. That's what Moses was meant to tell Aaron, not just what he should do, but inspire him to do it in an enthusiastic way. And not just once, but for the present and also for future generations for all time. Are you with me on this? So it's about being so inspired that every time you do it, it's going to be amazing. Rabbi Shimon taught, Scripture especially needs to urge people to do commandments where monetary loss is involved. So when it costs you something, you buy matzah, it costs money. You buy wine for the Seder, sure, costs something. Build a sukkah, wood doesn't grow on trees. Wait a second. It literally does. But it costs money. You like that lesson? So yeah, it costs money to do a mitzvah. You buy your citron, you buy your esro, you buy your lulav. These things cost. So when there's some financial, you know, when there's skin in the game, the Torah has to specifically, God specifically gets on you to be motivated and excited. What's the financial loss in this case? Well, it's sacrifices, it's time, it's money, it's effort, it's clothing that gets there, whatever. It's all the stuff that's involved, physical labor involved in this. So therefore, requires a zrizut, a special specific encouraging. This is how Rashi explains the word Tzav, which, oh, by the way, is the name of the Torah portion, Tzav. So what does Tzav mean? Well, simply it means command, but more layered, more nuanced. It doesn't just mean command. It means urge, encourage, to do it promptly and meticulously and for all time, not just for now. It's all of this energy that is meant to be conveyed from Moses to Aaron, to his kids, and from them to their kids. In other words, it's not just about passing inspiration forward, but it's inspiring the other one so much that they'll inspire the next one after them. And let me just jump in and make sure that what I'm saying makes sense. This is not just person A inspiring person B. This is person A inspiring person B to be so inspired that they're going to, on their own, want to inspire person C to such an extent that C is going to inspire D and D is going to inspire E. You know what this is the story of? Judaism. This is the story of Judaism. This is the story. This is why we're here. Because somebody didn't just get it and say, interesting, oh, well, we're done. Somebody got it from the previous generation and said, you know what? This is so interesting. This is so compelling. This is so life-affirming and meaningful and amazing that I'm going to share it with the next one. I'm going to pass it forward. That's why we're here. So this is about not only inspiring the next one, but inspiring the next one to be a source of inspiration to the one after them. That's what we're talking about here. Another element on this, I told you, this is like, we didn't do this yesterday, but it's a lot, it's a world of insight in this one word. That's the name of the Torah portion. Tzav is also, as Rashi said, being so inspired that you're new today and tomorrow. It's easy to be inspired the first time you do something. First time you wrap tefillin, oh, it's amazing. It's new. It's got that fresh new tefillin smell, right? It's everything's new. It's a new mitzvah. It's a new experience. First time you attend a Seder, eat matzah, it's interesting, it's crunchy, whatever. But when you've done it for a long time, for many years, you know, at some point it can feel a little stale, can feel a little like this again, not so inspiring. And the point of tzav is that every time you do it, every year or every day or every generation, whatever context it is, it should be as fresh, as inspiring, as urgent as the first time. Human beings, by nature, we get excited for new things. We get excited when things are new and fresh. The point of this is to be excited, as excited, even when it's not so new and fresh. That's the big idea here. There's a verse in Torah, I think it's in Deuteronomy, where Moses tells the people, don't serve idols, the ones that your parents never knew. We studied this inside. The phrase is something like, don't serve idols, and mention specifically the idols that your parents never knew. What's the point of adding that? All idols are off limits. What does it mean that the idols that your parents didn't know? So according to some, Moses is telling us the psychology of why you would worship those idols. Why? Because everyone wants to feel some fresh energy. You don't want to just do what your parents did. So you'll specifically find an idol that your parents didn't serve, because that way to you, you get that high of finding something new, a new experience. So Moses says, don't do that by worshiping false idols and foreign idols. Find that within your own tradition. Find that within your own faith. Find that within your own Yiddishkeit, within your own Judaism. Make it fresh so that you don't need to look at something else that's external. You don't need to look elsewhere because this is fresh. Make it fresh because it is fresh. All right, so that's it. That's with the opening verse. Now on to third reading. Any questions or comments on that? Good? I have two thumbs up, actually, but one was off screen. Okay, let's jump into our Torah text. Where is our Torah text? I think I found it. Can you guys see that? Beautiful. So we spoke about the offerings, the Ola offering. We spoke about the Shlamim. We spoke about the Mincha. So again, the burnt offering, the peace offering, the meal offering. We spoke about the sin offering. We spoke about the guilt offering and the various observances that were involved in those offerings. Essentially, Tzav, this Torah portion, is elaborating on the introduction, the themes that we introduced last week as we started the book of Leviticus with the offering. So these are more details. Let's talk about the peace offering in more detail today. Leviticus chapter 7, let's jump in with verse 11. And this is the law of the peace offering, which he shall bring to the Lord. If he is bringing it as a thanksgiving offering, and we'll talk about that in a moment. Thanksgiving. Where does Thanksgiving come from? Boom. You saw it right here first. So if he's bringing it as a thanksgiving offering, he shall offer turkey. Joking. He shall offer, along with the thanksgiving offering, unleavened loaves mixed with oil, unleavened wafers anointed with oil, and scalded flour mixed with oil. There you go. Along with loaves of leavened bread, he shall bring his offering along with his thanksgiving peace offering. So this is the example, one example of a peace offering. The peace offering is an offering that parts of that offering were eaten by the person who brought it and by the priest who brought it and by the altar itself that was burnt on the altar. So this is a peace offering specifically in the form of a thanksgiving offering known as the Karban Todah. Like, you ever hear the expression Todah Rabah? Thank you very much. Todah. This is a Karban Todah, a thanks offering, thanksgiving offering. So in addition to the actual thanksgiving offering, which we'll speak about in a moment, so there has to be unleavened loaves and wafers and flour and loaves of leavened bread. In fact, there was meant to be a ton of loaves of leavened breads, a lot of them. Let's see if we find an amount here. I think there was something like a few dozen loaves that were brought. Okay, I don't see the number right here, but if I recall correctly, there's a lot of loaves that are brought along with the Thanksgiving offering. So let's explain why and what and where and how and who. What's the Thanksgiving offering? So traditionally, a person would bring the Thanksgiving offering upon encountering four scenarios. Either, number one, a person got out of jail, or a person healed from an illness, or a person traversed the desert, or a person traversed the sea. If you cross the sea, cross the desert, heal from illness, or get out of jail, in any of these cases, you would bring in the temple of old a Thanksgiving offering, a Karban Todah, an offering of thanks. It's a peace offering because it's eaten by all the parties involved, but it's specifically in the form of a Thanksgiving offering. Something happens, something amazing, and thanks is offered with this offering. But the cool thing about these loaves of leavened bread, again, I don't remember the exact number right now. I don't want to make it up either, but it was a significant number of loaves of bread, and it all had to be eaten. And you can't eat it yourself. I mean, how much bread can you eat? So this encouraged, or this mandated, right, essentially that the person who was celebrating the personal, you know, victory or the personal good news would actually bring in others in the celebration and share the food with them. Does that make sense what I just said? Part of the offering is to eat bread, is to bake bread, loaves of bread, and to eat them. And that means if you have to eat all this bread, then you have to invite friends and family to join with you. And this way, a person's private celebration would become more of a communal or at least familial, at least somewhat more of a public celebration. The idea is that we should celebrate not just privately, but we should celebrate with loved ones and friends and community good occasions. Even till this day, we don't have a temple. But when somebody experiences good news, right? A family simcha or a, you know, getting healed from being sick or, you know, getting out of jail if that's the case, or even when somebody, you know, does international travel, there is a blessing that said, thanking God. And many have a tradition to sponsor, let's say, a kiddush, you know, a luncheon at the synagogue, Shabbat afternoon, to kind of celebrate and eat and enjoy with others and share the story, tell the story and inspire others as to the kindness of Hashem. Now today, quarantine, whatever, you know, we're still easing our way out of a pandemic, so we're not 100% there yet with kiddush sponsorships and Thanksgiving celebrations. Nonetheless, this is a profound Jewish value, the idea of gratitude, and it's reflected right here in our discussion of the offerings, and it's one of the forms of peace offerings that were brought in the temple. So again, the core idea here is that when something good happens, acknowledge, remember where it's coming from, give thanks to the Almighty, and celebrate in the proper way. Let's continue. He shall bring it. And if anyone who has a question, comment, just jump right in. Don't wait for me to ask. Just jump right in. And he shall bring from it one out of each offering as a separation to the Lord. The Kohen who dashes the blood of the peace offering, it shall be his. Let's see what that means. Rashi says, one loaf out of each kind. He shall take these as a truma, separation for the Kohen officiating at a sacrifice. So one loaf out of all the different types. We had unleavened loaves and wafers and then regular leavened loaves. So one of each kind of starch was given to the Kohen who was helping. And then, a separation for the Kohen officiating. The rest is eaten by the owner, with the exception of the breast and the thigh of the animal, which we'll talk about soon, as the waving of the breast and the thigh of a peace offering is delineated below, and a thanksgiving offering is called a peace offering, and consequently, we apply the laws of a peace offering to it. So therefore, since it's a peace offering, some of it goes to the altar, some to the Kohen, and some to the individual who is bringing the offering himself. Hope that made sense. So some of it goes to the Kohen, some to the altar, and the rest is eaten by the person who brought it. That was verse 14. Verse 15. And the flesh of his thanksgiving peace offering shall be eaten on the day it is offered up. He shall not leave any of it over until morning. In other words, he eats it. He eats the thanksgiving offering, the meat of the animal, with the exception of, we just read, the breast and the thigh that are given to the altar as a wave offering. But if his sacrifice is a vow or a voluntary donation, on the day he offers up his sacrifice, it may be eaten. On the next day, whatever is left over from it may be eaten. So when it's a thanksgiving peace offering, so you can't, it has to be finished on the day and the night. It can't be left till the next morning. But if it's a vow or voluntary donation, a bit of a different type of offering, then it could be eaten even the next day, right? On the next day, it's still meant, you can still have the leftovers. You don't have to burn it because it's holy. You can still eat it the next day. However, what is left over from the flesh of the sacrifice on the third day, that should be burnt in fire. So some sacrifices, some offerings had to be eaten either that day or that immediate night afterwards. But by daybreak the next morning, whatever was left had to be burnt. Some you had one more day, but after that day, that was it. Just depending on the sacrifices. So I hope it made sense what we said here. The Thanksgiving peace offering, you have 24 hours. The other one, you have 36 hours, 48 hours, whatever it is. But on the next day, the third day, it's done. And if any of the flesh, verse 18, if any of the flesh of his peace offering is to be eaten on the third day, right? Not the Thanksgiving offering, the peace offering that you had an extra day, but on the third day, it shall not be accepted. It shall not count for the one who offers it. Rather, it shall be rejected. The person who eats of it shall bear his sin. So you can't eat it on day number three. It doesn't work. You have to eat it before and burn whatever's left. And the flesh that touches anything unclean shall not be eaten. So if the meat of the sacrifice that you were going to eat touches anything impure, you can't eat it. You got to burn it in fire. But regarding the flesh, anyone who is clean may eat the flesh. So you have to be in a state of cleanliness and make sure that it doesn't touch anything that is unclean or impure. A person who eats the flesh of a peace offering of the Lord while his uncleanness is upon him. So in other words, in a state of ritual impurity, if you eat from the offering in an unclean state, doesn't mean physically, it means spiritually unclean with the different types of impurities that the Torah speaks of. So that's a pretty significant misdeed. It says the punishment is that soul shall be cut off from its people, which is the idea of kares, which is one of the highest, it's a spiritual form of consequence where the soul is actually a little bit ostracized. Now, it doesn't mean fully and irrevocably, there's always a way back, but it means there's now, that's already a severe thing to do, to eat the flesh of a peace offering in a state of uncleanliness. By the way, in case anyone's concerned about this, today, there are no peace offerings, you don't have a temple, and we're all in a state of uncleanliness. So enjoy your barbecue, just don't call it a peace offering. Next, verse 21. And a person who touches anything unclean, whether uncleanness from a human or an unclean animal carcass, or any unclean carcass of an abominable creature, and then eats of the flesh of a peace offering to the Lord, that soul shall be cut off from its people. Again, kind of the same thing. There's probably a nuance that this verse is adding over the other one, but essentially it's just repeating the prohibition against eating a sacrifice in a state of tumah, ritual impurity. All right, verse 22. Here we go. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, you shall not, you shall not eat any fat of an ox, sheep, or goat. By the way, it doesn't mean any fat. All meat has fat. You know, you have a steak, there's a little fat in it, but it means certain, the forbidden fats. Don't eat any of that fat on these types of animals, ox, sheep, or goat. The fat of carrion and the fat of an animal with a fatal disease or injury. In other words, an animal that you can't eat because it's not kosher anymore. It was killed in the field. What is carrion? Yeah, is that like luggage in a Delta? Carrion? Anybody know the definition? I'm going to look this up. I believe it means something killed.
It's an animal that eats the dead.
Yeah.
Like a buzzard.
Well, it's actually, according to this, it's a noun. It's the decaying flesh of dead animals. Yeah. So it could be a kosher type of animal that died and is now, I don't know, you want to say roadkill. It's now dead. It's now lying dead, deceased. It wasn't slaughtered properly. It's dead. It's a kosher type of animal, but it wasn't slaughtered properly. And that's it. So you can't eat it. It's not kosher. It might be a cow, but it's not kosher. Or an animal that was slaughtered properly, but it had a fatal disease or injury. And as I said, I think I explained this a day or two. I think I did at some point that even a kosher animal that is slaughtered properly, you have to check the internal organs to make sure that it was a healthy animal. And that's why there's a conception that kosher is healthy, because it literally is. Literally, an animal that's not healthy is not kosher. It might be a cow. There might have been a ritual slaughter or shochet who did everything per spec, per the law. Still not kosher if it's not healthy. So literally, kosher is a healthy animal. Otherwise, it's no good. So what happens if you have a cow that either killed, lying in the field now, or it was shechted, or it was slaughtered, but it had a fatal disease or injury? So you can't eat it. But what about the fats? Can you use it for any other purpose? So the answer is yes. It may be used for any work, but you shall not eat it. And this is where the Torah differentiates between the prohibition against consumption and the prohibition against deriving pleasure from a thing. There are certain things that are forbidden to eat, but you are allowed to sell it. I think I mentioned this a few days ago. You have a kosher slaughterhouse. When something's not kosher, they sell it to the non-kosher meat peoples. You're allowed to profit off of it. It doesn't mean, because something's not kosher, doesn't mean you have to put your hands up and walk backwards and then start running when you're 5 meters away. That's not what it means. If it's not kosher, you can't eat it. You know, people say, what about medication or a vaccine, whatever, that has non-kosher ingredients in it? Are you eating a vaccine? I've never seen a vaccine go in like that. I don't want to make this about vaccines. I'm just saying you're not eating it. Oh, you're benefiting from it. No problem. Here we go. Leviticus 7:24. Yeah, might not be kosher, but it may be used for any work. You're allowed to benefit from it. In halachic terminology, there's an isser. Isser means prohibition. There's an isser achila, prohibition against eating. And then there's the question about hana. Hana means pleasure, deriving benefit from it. Now, there are certain things that you even can't derive benefit from. And I'll give you an example. Famously, meat and milk, the mixture of meat and milk, not only can you not cook it without eating it, not only can you not eat it without cooking it, you can't even have benefit, profit from it, which means that even if you're not eating from it, to own a cheeseburger restaurant, to make money, profit off of the mixing of meat and milk, would be problematic. Does that make sense, what I just said? And how do we know this? Because the Torah repeats the prohibition against meat and milk three times. And we know from this, it means three different prohibitions. Once again, one prohibition is about cooking it. Even if you're not eating it, you cannot cook it together. Number two, you can't eat them together. No matter how they got together, you can't eat them together. And number three, you cannot benefit or profit in any way off of the mixture of meat and milk. So that's just an example of meat and milk and the mixture and the prohibition. But here, when it comes to the fat of these animals that we can't eat, the Torah says they still may be used for any work. You're allowed to benefit from it. Yes.
Rabbi, so can you explain why, if it was to give a sacrifice, why the people giving the sacrifice were permitted to eat in certain constraints to eat it? I mean, you would think that if it's a sacrifice, then you wouldn't be able to eat it ever yourself.
Yes, certain sacrifices were like that, what you're saying. Certain sacrifices were totally for the altar and burnt. Certain sacrifices were meant for the person to enjoy as well. I'm giving some to God, but I'm also enjoying some of it. And the example that we have today is the Thanksgiving offering, where you're bringing a sacrifice to God, thanking God for the blessing in your life, the miracle in your life. But at the same time, you're also enjoying, you're celebrating yourself, the miracle, and you're getting in the festive mood yourself by enjoying part of the food as well. So I don't know if I answered it or if I just contextualized it, and maybe that helps understand it. You're right. You would think if you're just giving an offering to God, so then don't get involved. But again, depending on the sacrifice and the type that you're bringing, there is a rationale to say you should also enjoy it. And the Kohen who helps could also enjoy some of it. So it's not either or. There's different types of sacrifices with different types of sharing or not sharing features. But this is specifically talking about fats. So there are forbidden fats, and that can never be eaten, but it could be used for other purposes. And here the Torah says, once again, the prohibition. For anyone who eats fats of animals from which sacrifices are brought as fire offerings to the Lord, the soul who eats it shall be cut off from its people. Again, it's a serious deal. Don't do it. Next, and these prohibitions against fat and blood consumption, certain fat and blood consumption, we find frequently, we had it yesterday's reading, we talked about it last week as well, but here once again, the prohibition. And you shall not eat, and by the way, the Talmud does a great job of every time it repeats it, the Talmud says it's adding this law or it's qualifying that law, and that's what the Talmud, a lot of what the Talmud does is explain repetition of verses, that it's not repetitious, it's rather further instructive, but we don't have time to get into all the details. And you shall not eat any blood, no blood eating in any of your dwelling places, whether from birds or from animals. Anyone who eats blood, that soul shall be cut off from its people. So again, kares, don't do it. All right, let's continue. And the Lord spoke to Moses saying, 29, speak to the children of Israel saying, anyone who brings his peace offering to the Lord shall bring his sacrifice to the Lord from his peace offering. There you go. So if you bring your peace offering to God, so he shall bring it to God from his peace offering. In other words, from his peace offering means not the whole thing. Some of it he's going to eat, but some of it from that should go to God. Does that make sense? This is how we know that some of it is consumed by the person who brought it as well. His own hands shall bring the fire offerings of the Lord, the fat on the breast. He shall bring it, the breast, to wave it as a waving before the Lord. And the Kohen shall cause the fat to go up in smoke on the altar, and the breast shall belong. Oh, I'm sorry, I misspoke before. It's the breast and the thigh that go to the Kohen. The fats go on the altar to be burnt. So he first does a wave offering. He lifts it up and moves it around. There's a specific formula to how to do that. And then the Kohen shall cause the fat to go up in smoke on the altar, and the breast shall belong to Aaron and his sons, and you shall give the right thigh also as an elevation offering to the Kohen from your peace offering. So again, this peace offering, some of it, the majority was eaten by the person who brought it. Some of it went to the Kohen, and the fats and other parts went to the altar to be burnt. Any one of the sons of Aaron who offers up the blood of the peace offering and the fat, he shall have the right thigh as a portion. So if you participated in it as a Kohen, you have the right to eat part of that part of the animal. For I have taken the breast of the waving and the thigh of the elevation from the children of Israel, from their peace offerings, and I've given them to Aaron the Kohen and to his sons as an eternal statute from the children of Israel. God says, I'm hooking up the priests with these parts of the offerings. This is the grant for Aaron's atonement and his son's atonement from the fire offerings of the Lord and the day that he brought them near to be Kohanim for the Lord. In other words, this is what is granted to Aaron. There's a perk of being a Kohen. You don't own land. You don't have a day job. So how do you eat? How are you supported? Through your service in the temple, you get a piece here, a piece there. Yeah, that's how you live. So this is the grant. This is what's granted for Aaron's atonement and his son's anointment. I may have said atonement. Aaron's anointment and his son's anointment from the fire offerings of the Lord on the day that he brought them near to be accounted to the Lord, which the Lord commanded to give them on the day that he anointed them from the children of Israel. This is an eternal statute for their generations. The idea of benefiting the Kohen with these gifts of the peace offering. This is the law for the burnt offering, the meal offering, and the sin offering, and the guilt offering, and for the investitures, and for the peace offering. In other words, this is the summary verse. All of the aforementioned are the laws for all these different types of offerings, which the Lord commanded Moses on Mount Sinai on the day he commanded the children of Israel to offer up their sacrifice to the Lord in the Sinai desert. So these are the commandments that God gave to Moses on Mount Sinai. And then Moses communicated with the people, and that's what happened. By the way, in case you're wondering, why are we back at Sinai? I thought we're past Sinai. We've mentioned many times, Moses spent 40 days on the mountain. He wasn't suntanning. He was learning the law from God. God was teaching him the law that he then taught over the next little while. When Moses came down from the mountain that first time, the people were worshiping the golden calf, and that was a process to fix that and then to get back on schedule. Once they got back on schedule, the first thing was building the Mishkan. They built the tabernacle and then had to operate within that structure, the offerings, the roles of the priests and all the different animals. All of that was delineated. But originally, all that was taught to Moses back up on the mountain on those original 40 days. Does that make sense? So Torah was communicated to Moses by God, primarily on Mount Sinai, and then it was delivered to the people as it unfolded. Okay, so that is today. So what insight do I want to leave you with today? Number one, Tzav, the name of the portion. Tzav is zeros. Tzav means alacrity. Tzav means we're not sleeping on the job. Tzav means we're excited about the job, right? So it's about the excitement and the passion. So number one, we need to be passionate. No stale Judaism. Fresh, excited, vibrant, enthusiastic, and be so enthusiastic that when somebody sees you, they become enthusiastic. That's the point. Be a force of energy that others can't help, not just to be swept up in it, but they themselves will be their own force of energy to then pass, pay it forward and pass it along to someone else. So that's one message that I want to leave you with. The second message is regarding the Thanksgiving offering, as I mentioned before. When the miracles in our lives happen, and maybe they're big and maybe they're just a little, maybe just something worked out. You know, I was looking for something and it worked out. I got a phone call and whatever, something worked out. Let's pay attention and let's give thanks where thanks is due. No, we're not schlepping an animal to the temple and we're not doing a wave offering of a thigh and a breast and all the loaves of bread that came along with it. We're not doing that today. What we can do is offer a few thoughts, a few words of prayer to God to thank God for the blessings that we have. All too often, we end up fetching about what we don't have. But let's spend some time being thankful and having gratitude. In fact, it's not just good for God, it's good for us. Maybe it's more about us than even God. God needs our thank you. It's nice, but it's more about us. Ask any positive psychologist worth their degree today, and they'll tell you that one of the most effective things that you and I can do to boost our positivity and happiness quotient is keep a gratitude journal or write down each day a few things that we're grateful for, a few things that we appreciate, a few blessings in our lives. And just thinking about the blessings and articulating them, even for ourselves, is profoundly transformative. We have an opportunity to do this every morning. We say, Moda Ani, thank God for being alive. Thank you, Hashem, for returning my soul into me, returning my soul to me and for giving me life once again today. We don't take things for granted. Rather, we appreciate what we have. And with that, it benefits us. And that's like the Shlomim. As much as was given to the altar and the Kohen, it was the one who brought it who benefited the most. And that's not a problem. It's not a sin. It's a good thing. If we know where the blessings come from, it's okay that we're happy and we celebrate it and we enjoy it. That's what God wants us to enjoy the blessings. It's important for us to know though where they come from. All right. Thank you for joining me today for DPP. I hope this made sense. I hope you enjoyed it. Tomorrow is Wednesday. Same bat time, same bat channel. We're on. Given the nature of Erev Pesach and just everything going on at Chabad and cleaning and everything and just organizing and whatnot, we're not going to be in person. We'll be on Zoom, but hopefully after Pesach, we'll get back into our routine and we're going to be, please God, meeting more and more often on a steady and consistent basis, which I'm looking forward to. And also on Zoom. All right. Great to see everybody. Any questions, comments?
I have a question for Zohamed. Sure. So we have to sell it by Friday morning, but we can still have challah.
Correct.
And then
we sell it with the, it with the intention, because you can't sell it, you know, after on Shabbat, you can't make a transaction. So we sell it Friday and we do it early enough where it hits that time where it would typically be the time to sell it on a normal, not normal, but when it's not Shabbat, Erev Pesach is not Shabbat. So we do it by the morning, but we have in mind that the sale is contingent. You know, the official sale is going to go into effect the next day at whenever it is, like 12 o'clock or something. You have to finish eating by like 11 something and you can't own it, has to be gone by 12 something. So here's the deal when it comes to selling and it comes and owning chametz. So on Passover, the prohibition is not only not to eat the chametz, but even to possess it and to own it and to derive any benefit from it. Again, the benefit issue. So it's supposed to be completely out. Now, what if you have a box of Cheerios and you like your box of Cheerios and it's in a nice airtight container and you would love to eat them after Passover and you just want to have them gone for a week? Can you do that? The answer is yes. You sell your chametz to someone who isn't Jewish. And that way, over Passover, you don't own it. Even if it's in your closet, you tape it up, you close the door, whatever it is, and it's no longer yours. And then after Passover is over, the sale reverses, and now you can have your own thing. Now, how do you sell the chametz? We're going to have to find someone to do it. You don't need to do it. Rabbis will sell it for you. So you can go on our website, not the In-Town Jewish Academy, but chabadintown.org/Passover, and there's a form there to sell your chametz. You specify where you live, and your time zone, or your address, and your chametz effectively will be sold. Rabbis sell chametz on behalf of many, 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 many people. You could do it on Chabad.org, on the mothership website. You could do it, you know, different ways. The main thing is that we don't see, or even officially possess and own the chametz. And so again, if it still is in our house, just put it away in a cabinet, just tuck it away and put a piece of tape over it, non-sticking too much tape. You know, you don't want to like peel it off and your cabinet wood finish comes off. That would be awkward. And blaming the rabbi, do not blame the rabbi. Use like, it's a good tape. Not masking tape is a little bit harsh. They have gaffer's tape, is that what it's called? Whatever, there are certain tapes that are non-marking tapes. Use a non-marking tape, tape up your cabinet or your closet or your pantry, whatever it is, where you have your chametz stored.
Paint.
And that's it. Yeah, painter's tape, the blue stuff, right, exactly. And just put it away, sell it, and you're done. Oh, and then the challah, your question is, what about the challah on Shabbat? You have in mind that the sale is officially selling all your chametz, but you're going to have a certain amount that's out that you're going to finish or destroy by the time the sale officially kicks in legally. So by the 12, whatever it is, time on Saturday, you'll either have eaten it or put it away, and a challah, it's not going to stay for a week. It's going to get whatever.
No.
Cheerio stays a little bit better, but not challah. That's not a good idea, unless you want green challah to do an experiment and find maybe some sort of cure to something. But anyway, the point is that that you want to get rid of it, so flush it down the toilet or finish or eat it, and that's it. But you can sell it. It's not a problem. This year, that's how the sale works.
Okay. Thank you.
It's easy peasy. It'll take you 2 minutes online to do. But then it's not just about selling it. You have to then just put it away, and that's it. And so what do you eat during Passover? Matzah, fruits and vegetables, whatever else you eat. But just nothing of the leavened varietal. All right, good. Hope that makes sense. Awesome. Great to see you all. We'll see you tomorrow. And have a wonderful day. Bye, everybody. See you soon. Thank you.